Yo people, Anna David with After Party Pod. After Party Pod is a part of After Party Magazine, a website determined to change the face and get rid of the stigma around addiction and recovery. Now, After Party is a part of RehabReviews.com, the world's largest resource for treatment centers across the globe. You can go there to see if your rehab stay could be free. Go to rehabreviews.com/benefits-check. What else can you do there, you may ask? You can get a RecoverGirl t-shirt. Go to rehabreviews.com/recovergirlshirt. Sorry, guys. Anyway, you'd know all of this if you were signed up for our newsletter. What are you doing? Go sign up. rehabreviews.com/newsletter-sign-up. Now here's the show.
Welcome to the after party. It's time to change. You're just getting started. You can teach an old dog new ways, and not just on Saturday.
Hey guys, it's Anna David. A little bit under the weather, Anna David. Very rare occurrence. I started to get a cold. I woke up with a sore throat maybe 4 days ago, and I thought, I have a cold. And I kind of like it because it's so different than the way I normally feel. So, I mean, God bless the people around me, because I'll talk about it as if it's this cool, exciting thing. And nobody thinks a cold is cool and exciting, except me. And now it's lasted 4 days. And it confuses me a little bit. This morning, I woke up coughing, you know, like the days when I used to smoke pack cigarettes a day. And I thought, you know how when you wake up in the morning, you feel the absolute worst and you go, oh, well, I mean, I'm destroyed today. There's no way I can do anything. And then you kind of stand up and you realize that was just waking up. That happened. I'm now fine. But do you hear that frog in my throat that's kind of sexy? Yeah. I'm not putting it on for you. And so what else do I want to tell you? Big day today. This is going to be out of date. Supreme Court ruled that same-sex marriage is legal. Why are people texting me while I'm talking to you? I'm obsessing over the fact that Obama was on Mark Maron's podcast last week. I can't remember if I talked to you about that in the last recording, but wow. And it worked. Whatever happened, I listened to it and I woke up the next morning and I sort of thought, it's so weird. Obama and I are kind of friends now. He was so great on it. I'm an Obama fan anyway. So there was something else I wanted to say. Oh, two things that will not be breaking news by the time you listen to this. We have started an after party reading series. Which will not be that serious. If you are in LA, you are cordially invited to come. If you are not in LA, you're cordially invited to fly out for it. Sure. July 9th at Muse Cafe, which is on La Brea and 8th Street. I think that's considered Hollywood, maybe West Hollywood. Anyway, you'll find it. And Danielle Stewart, Tracy Chabala, Sevasti Iyami, Amber Tozer are all going to be reading /telling stories about their funniest and best pieces from the site. And we're going to do it every month. So this is our first foray into that. I used to have a storytelling show called True Tales of Lust and Love. Go download that if you want. But so this is great. I'm super excited about it. The other thing is that I hope this will have happened by the time you listen to this, Danielle. And I are talking about doing today, recording something called After Party Cuts, a video series where we'll talk about stories on the site, but in a fun way. I actually announced this on a previous podcast and it never happened because we're doing a lot of other work around here, the less fun work a lot of the time. So anyway, we have a hard date of today to do this. Let me talk about today's guest. It's Dr. Alan Berger, who is, let's talk about him. He has been sober 44 years. He looks 44, so that's weird. And he's a PhD in private practice, and he's written numerous books about recovery. I'm holding one of these, you can't see that, called 12 Stupid Things That Mess Up Recovery, Avoiding Relapse Through Self-Awareness and Right Action. And he told me that it's sold 50,000 copies and counting. Do you guys know how many books that is? It supposedly takes 5,000 to be on the bestseller list if they're all kind of bought in a certain week. But yeah, so this is, you know, top 20 on Amazon in certain category. I mean, whatever. It's massively successful. And the way that do I talk about this in the episode? I hate when I make a big deal about something in an intro and then I realize it's totally redundant with something I told the guest in the episode. But I heard him speak at a meeting and I'm like, who is this brilliant man? And somebody slipped in the meeting and said, that was so great, Dr. Berger. And so my friend who was sitting next to me, who's, you know, hopefully listening, he's a fan of the podcast, he Googles that and, you know, turns his phone to me and says, oh, this is who this guy is. He's this author, PhD. So we knew that. And so I asked him to be on the podcast. That was months ago. He's a very busy man. And he drove all the way from Westlake Village, which only means something to you if you are in LA. And if you are in LA, that's exciting because you're coming to our first reading series, right? Anyway, we had such a good conversation. It's nice because I haven't had a expert. Well, I guess you could say Pat Allen is in recovery and also, you know, a therapist who sees clients and whatnot, but who struggled with addiction, who talks about it and is able, and he's brilliant. So he's able to apply a lot of psychoanalytic theories in terms of how he talks about recovery. Such a good conversation. So you can find him online at ABPhD. You can find his books on Amazon. And he tells me at the end of the episode about his CDs and other things. So you'll hear that at the end of the episode. Right now, I'm just going to give them to you. Dr. Alan Berger.
I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash.
Oh my God. I think my copy has like blood stains on it from shooting up while reading it.
Party animal. I hate to say that because that makes me sound Paris Hilton. I was on the, as right. I call it, the Autobahn to nowhere.
I'm very lucky because would you have wanted to have a celebrity junkie for a dad?
Okay, so yeah, why not start by talking about how well your book is doing?
We can do that.
So I asked, so you weren't bragging, over 50,000 copies sold on 12 Stupid Things People Do to Mess Up Their Recovery?
Yes. It's really been received well. And this is the kind of book that gets momentum through word of mouth.
Yeah.
Because when people read it, they really walk away with some very, very practical ideas about what they can do to strengthen their recovery. You know, we kind of go through the back door. We say 12 stupid things that mess up recovery.
Right.
But what we're really talking about is what do you need to do to really, really ground your recovery in some solid psychological ideas?
Right.
And that's been my life's work.
If you had to summarize in less than a minute what the 12 things are that people do to mess up their recovery, how would you do that?
I think the best way to say it is people have overgeneralized certain ideas about what they need to do. And that overgeneralization creates a lot of problems. So, you know, like thinking you got to be perfect. That's mm-hmm. a great example, mm-hmm. right? If I think I have to be perfect, I put so much pressure on myself.
Right.
And then when I don't live up to that standard, I end up hating myself. I end up putting myself down. I have a heck of a time. So one of the things that I try to do is help people get a more realistic
Right.
standard for themselves,
yeah.
and expectation for themselves. And that's what I'm hoping to do in 12 Stupid Things.
Yeah, it's interesting. I will say that to people. Well, I mean, I definitely say it to sponsees, but also people who tell me, writers who tell me they have writer's block. And this goes for addicts and non-addicts. writer's block is only perfectionism.
Yeah.
Because if you understand that your first, what you write at first isn't going to not be good,
yeah,
you don't have writer's block.
Exactly.
You know?
Then you just go with the process.
Yeah.
You see where it takes you. That's what happened with 12 Stupid Things for me, is I had some general ideas, but I think you've experienced as a writer, is the book starts to reveal itself to you,
yes,
as you're writing it.
Yes.
You know, you've heard many great artists say that.
Right.
You know, I start carving this stone and what's inside of it starts to speak to me. Well, that's the same experience I have in writing. I'm imagining the same experience you have.
Yeah, it's interesting because I used to get, when I was doing novels, the best way, I'm not a brainstorm at the computer person. I'm a just let it flow out person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then I would go and get massages. This is great advocacy for self-indulgence.
Yeah,
and it was like my, whatever you want to call it, my, you know, subconscious, my little brain, my big brain as opposed to my little brain would open up. And I would suddenly have all these ideas and I would have to rush out of the massage and just like jot everything down.
Well, you know, what you're saying is, and there's really some great solid neuropsychology behind that. Our brain is always working on these issues.
Yeah.
And see, you know, that's what they captured in The Secret. You know, I'm not a new age guy, but the neuropsychology behind it is you put something in your consciousness and say, look, I want to write this book. Well, guess what? You're writing it all the time.
Right.
You may not be sitting down in front of your computer or even having a stream of consciousness, but you're constantly working on it. And that is what becomes revealed to us.
But then there are those millions of people that are sort of, quote, constantly working on it that never sit down at the computer.
Well, see, that's the procrastination. And what is that caused by? Like you said, perfectionism.
Perfectionism.
Because I got to do it perfect.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, if I don't do it perfect, I'm going to hate myself. So that's why we don't even take the risk, is because what people are doing is avoiding that self-hate.
Right. That's interesting. Do you think all procrastination is perfectionism?
Every person. And so an interesting thing I do, so let's take this into my office now.
Yeah.
So what I would do is, if I was working with someone who's procrastinating, I would have them separate themselves.
Uh-huh.
So I do a lot of what's called the shuttle technique.
Okay.
Because it's, see, mental health is defined as a coordination of all that we are.
Right.
So you got a whole committee that lives inside.
Oh,
you hear this in program all the time, right? God, I got a committee in my head. It's driving me nuts. Well, it's only driving you nuts because the committee's not working together.
Right.
So in the kind of therapy I do, Gestalt therapy, what we do is try to get the committee to work together. So one way to do that is to get people to separate the different parts of themselves. So let's say I was working with you and you're procrastinating writing. So I would have the writer talking to the procrastinator.
Mm-hmm.
And
out
have
loud?
That out loud.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd start on one side, the part that wants to write, and say, listen, why don't you, you know, get out of the way so I can write. Then I'd have you switch over to chair and now be the procrastinator and answer.
Okay, wait. Now I want free therapy because that's not at all my issue. My issue,
all right,
but
we'll
I want
yours.
You to,
let's
yeah,
do
so
yours.
Mine.
Let's do
so
yours.
So mine is that I can, exercise addiction. It works for me, so hold on. I'm going to get back to that. But it's related. Never stop accomplishing. So it is very pleasant for me to accomplish.
Yes.
So I do not like sitting home.
Right.
I will read, but I reading during the day, oh my God, that feels like such a waste of time unless I have to, something I have to read. Sitting and watching a movie, ugh.
Yeah. So you're driven, is what you're saying. You're so driven.
But it's underneath it, it is for sure anxiety.
Yes. Okay, right. It's got something's driving the drivenness,
need.
Right? So what I would do...
But
if
wait,
we were, go ahead.
Doctor, all let right. me just give you one last fact. I do a double recording, so we're all good, but I just want to make sure that just in case...
Right.
Bad luck with recorders, but we're doing perfectly. I enjoy it so much that I don't believe it's unmanageable.
Well, you enjoy it so much, but there's a part of you that questions it, or else you wouldn't be bringing it up right now. See,
it's just
and
so...
that maybe is a little part of you.
Right.
But there's a part of you that says, how come there's not some room for me doing nothing? How come it's not okay for me to just hit the pause button,
mm-hmm.
check out for a while, and relax?
Mm-hmm.
So what we would do if we were doing a session
mm-hmm.
is in the one chair would be the driver. And in the other chair, the other part of you that's saying, hey, is there any room for us not to do this all the time?
Mm-hmm.
And to see what would happen with that conversation. Now, it would be interesting, but tell me, what do you think the driver would say to you? If you're on that side, part that's got to be driven, what would that be the message that side would be given to the other side?
Well, it would say, this feels so good.
I feel so good.
And I feel so good doing this. And what's the harm?
Okay, now let's switch to the other side. What does that side say to you?
So the other side says, it might feel great. How do you know that it wouldn't feel better to do nothing?
Right. And then go back to the other side now. Be the driver again.
Driver says, I've tried doing nothing.
And what happened?
And it's not great.
Yeah. Back to the other side.
Okay. Well, I do think there's something behind what it is. So maybe the non-driven side can say that.
All right, say it.
I think this comes from, you know, as always, something that happened between the ages of 0 and 12, which is that your dad infused the idea that you are not worthwhile unless you're accomplishing something.
What does the driver say to that?
Maybe that wasn't so bad. I get way more done than lots of people.
Okay. What does the other side say to that?
What if you work yourself into the ground?
Yeah.
What if you burn out? What if it is not healthy?
Yeah. And has it been not healthy sometimes?
Never.
Never, okay. So what does the other side say to that? That, it's never been not healthy?
So far.
So far, yeah. All right, so this is what I become aware of when you do that.
Okay.
See, the whole idea is that you have to be a certain way to be loved mm-hmm. and to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem in it.
Mm-hmm.
You see, it doesn't leave any room for being. It's always about doing.
Yeah.
So you're out of balance. And see, that is causing you problems. You may not be aware of it, but I will bet that you're out of balance in some areas of your life
mm-hmm.
because of that. So see, this work is about coming into balance with yourself. I talk a lot about emotional sobriety. So mm-hmm. what is emotional sobriety? Emotional sobriety is finding some balance, not just in your life. That's important too. You know, and that's what stuff like Recovery 2.0 is all about.
Yeah.
Tommy Rosen,
yeah,
all that stuff.
Previous podcast guest.
Right. But what I'm talking about is finding that balance between these different parts of yourself.
Right.
So that there's room within you for doing and accomplishing, which is great, but also for just being and being okay with that. You see, because if that's not a possibility, then what happens is now you've decreased your options. You must always be doing one thing. And there's no room for anything else. And sometimes you may need just to be.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it may be important for you to just back off a little bit and to be with yourself and mm-hmm. see what that means. Now, what happens with some people, when that starts to happen, is when they sit with themselves in the way I'm talking about, some pain starts to surface.
Mm-hmm.
Some sadness, some grief, some anxiety. And see, so a lot of times, and I don't know if you... You know, we've just met a couple times now.
Mm-hmm.
But see, that's what I would be interested in, is to see what happens when you let go of letting this part run the show
mm-hmm.
and you start to allow yourself to spend some time with this side of you, the being side. See, I'd call that the doing side.
Yeah.
I'd call this the being side.
Yeah, the human doing over human being.
Yeah, right?
Okay, and I know I sound very defensive.
Well,
but
get defensive. Come
but
on,
let me
go
tell
for
you this. I am somebody who... this is strange. When I get depressed,
yeah. And
I definitely do,
uh-huh.
I don't, I mean, this is related. I don't take to my bed and watch television and
right.
eat.
Probably not. What
no,
do you do?
I'm super high functioning, exactly
course.
The same
of
as
course.
Normal,
right.
but I'm crying yeah. and talking yeah. about it and doing things that my therapist says are great
yes.
to do, but I don't believe that I'm hiding sadness and discomfort
yeah.
from myself.
Yeah.
Because I can't help but feel it when I'm in that.
I got you. So what if you experimented with just laying in bed once? See,
yeah.
that's all I'm saying
yeah, yeah.
is you've got to open up all these possibilities. Because while that way may work a lot of times, you also may need to just lay in bed and give yourself that possibility. But see, what you've done is the way you've organized your personality, you've limited your possibilities.
Yeah.
When you limit your possibilities, then you've limited your ability to cope.
Right.
You get that? You
sort
see the relationship?
Sort of.
Should I explain it?
Well, how have I limited my ability to cope?
You can't lay in bed. You can't lay in bed.
But
it's not an option for you.
But if I'm... So
it's not an option. You just said it's not an option.
No, not an
I won't
option.
Lay in bed.
So, but arguably, I could feel better faster if I did that.
I don't know what you would feel. I'm not saying you'd feel better faster. I'm just saying that...
It's an option.
It's an option. And when you don't have all those options available, then you limit your ability to cope. Because
okay, yeah.
maybe one time laying in bed may be the best thing for you. But you're not going to experiment with that because that's not a possibility in the way you've organized your personality.
I've tried.
Well, okay, what happens?
Well, when I went through a breakup, I was very sad. I get sad for short bursts usually. So sad, especially at first. And I said to myself, okay, it was a Sunday that I was really feeling it. You can just lie in bed.
Mm-hmm.
And
so
don't
you gave
go
yourself
to your
the permission.
Don't go to
you
your meeting.
You didn't go to your meeting.
Hold on. Don't go to your dance class. Go to your meeting. Come back in bed.
Yeah.
I went to the 9 a.m. meeting where we met. Possibly this was the day you spoke. Who knows? And I didn't feel better. No, it wasn't. It couldn't have been the day you spoke. I didn't feel better. I said, go home, get in bed. I get in bed. And then I'm like, I really want to go to my dance class.
Yes.
I'm going to go. So I'd given myself permission,
mm-hmm.
but I just... And I was feeling my sadness all over
yeah.
anyway. But here, so if we were in therapy together and I wasn't
yeah.
getting this for free, you would possibly say to me, can you just try 10 minutes a day?
No, I wouldn't do that.
Okay.
What I would do is I would have you talk to your sadness.
Okay.
And to deal with the sad part of you and
okay.
see what happens. See, one of the things, one way you've coped, and I don't want to take this anything away from you. If that's working for you, fine. I just want to open up new possibilities because
mm-hmm.
that's what, to me, recovery is about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Learning is about the discovery of new possibilities. So there may be another way to deal with your sadness other than by mobilizing and energizing yourself. And see, that's one way you comfort yourself, and that's fine. I want you to have other ways.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. So I'd like you to be able to talk to that sad
mm-hmm.
part of you,
mm-hmm.
to deal with her, to embrace her, to comfort her in some other ways and not just mobilize her,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Because then that just opens up. Now, as I talk, I see you.
I don't like it. No,
my God. I wish we could see your face on this podcast. You're grimacing.
I'd do it.
Yeah, but see, you don't see it as... See, for you, nurturing is mobilizing.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would like you to consider is that there may be some other dimensions of nurturing that the way you've organized yourself doesn't allow you
yeah.
to appreciate, doesn't allow you to experience, doesn't allow you to value.
Okay, go on.
It does. No, but you just said it doesn't.
Well, no, I think that if my busyness when I was sad pushed all of those feelings away, then that would be true. But it doesn't.
I hear that.
All.
See, so that's what I said, is it helps you cope. I'm just saying there's other way.
Yeah.
I didn't say it didn't help you
yeah.
cope. I didn't say you were running away from it.
But I
just said there's another way.
Are you glad you're not my therapist?
No, I'm not glad. Or not one way or the other. I think, but you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Is that you need... It's not about that's not working.
Yeah, okay. There are options.
You don't have that,
yeah.
dear.
Yeah.
You've got a couple options right now, and they all have to do with this mobilization of your energy. I'm just saying, and that's one way of coping. Look, it's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't want to ever see you get that taken away.
Right.
But I'd want the other possibilities. You follow me? What might be less active and more what I would say comforting
mm-hmm.
and nourishing.
Mm-hmm.
I'd want you to have that possibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm open to it.
Well, let's see.
Let the record show I'm smiling.
You are smiling. Now we can show that.
So getting back to you, I'm not I'm stumbling over my words. I'm not shifting because I'm uncomfortable, but because we have to get to this.
Okay.
So you have been sober for how many decades?
Well, this summer I'll celebrate 44 years.
Jesus. And you look amazing. Can we talk about that?
Well, thank you.
Do people say, oh, yes, did you have your first
drink? Yeah, what did you get sober when you were in diapers or what happened to you?
How old were you?
Well, I was 19 years old.
Yeah, wow.
I was just back from Vietnam. I'm a Vietnam veteran.
Yeah, I just read that this morning. I don't think you mentioned that when you spoke.
I probably, you know, didn't. Sometimes I don't even remember what I say when I speak. Yeah. You have that experience too. You're so present. I went into Marine Corps at 17 to really escape. I was running away from myself.
Where were you from?
I was grew up in Chicago.
Okay.
Midwest.
Okay.
I was on the north side, northwest side of Chicago. And, you know, my dad died when I was young. We didn't deal with things in my family. We didn't address anything. I didn't know how to cope with the pain I was experiencing. It was a tremendous amount of pain. This man meant everything to me. He, you know... I can cry when I talk about him. He was this. He was the kind of dad that just got down on his knees and played with me.
Mm-hmm.
He got his hands dirty, took me out to the garage, loved being a father, and I love that he loved being with me. You know, it was that kind of an experience. So when he died, man, my world was rocked, and I dealt with it by shutting down. I didn't want to feel anything. I felt betrayed. I felt betrayed by life, by God, my mom. I don't know why I blamed her, but I did. You know, it was crazy. I was 10, 11 years old. A couple months after that, I picked up my first drink, and it worked. You know, it made me feel all alive again. And I was dead. Mm-hmm. I had died with my dad, or part of me had died with my dad. So that just opened up the door to my teenage alcoholism. I was a blackout drinker. I was drinking more than not, not going to school, you know, showing up to school first period, disappearing. I mean, I had 60 truances my first year. I don't even know how many days you're in class, but and then probably another 40 absences. I mean, I was gone all the time because I was out getting drunk.
And you weren't doing drugs?
Drugs came later.
Okay.
They came when I was 17. So this was back in the mid 60s. And there weren't a lot of drugs in my neighborhood. We were all drinkers. Old style beer, a lot of beer drinking going on. Some hard liquor came later on as we got older. But most of it was beer drinking. We'd get a couple cases of beer, go to a spot in the golf course and sit and get drunk, get lost, couldn't find ourselves our way out of the golf course, stuff like that, you know.
But wasn't it fun back then?
Well, I thought so.
Yeah.
I thought so. I believe so.
I mean, I look back on that period. I started around the same time, and yeah, I was doing to escape, but it was fun. Oh, I remember.
Listen, it was fun, but see, I never had the consciousness about what else was going on.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? It's like I didn't want to look at those other issues.
Sorry, I just had a panic. It's good. It's good. We're all good. You didn't want to look at those issues,
too much pain.
Quote unquote,
too much pain. I shut down the pain. I didn't want to feel anything but feel good. That's where the drinking worked for me. I just didn't want. Now, did I feel good all the time? No. I mean, when you wake up with the hangover, you're not feeling good. You know, I had a lot of blackouts where I was drinking to a point where I drank, and then I'd have the experience of not knowing what had happened the night before. Mm-hmm. And my friends tell me, you know, you're a real idiot, or you got in a fight with Bill Culver. What were you thinking? Culver, like, kills people. You know, it's stuff like this. I mean, that's what was going on for me. So, yeah, you know, I felt like it was fun.
And then, so you enrolled. Did you come from a military family?
My father served in World War II. He was in the Army. He was in Sicily. He received the Bronze Star for an act of bravery while he was over there. So my dad had served. I'm not aware of anybody else that had served in the family up to that point in time. So that was in the back of my mind. I wanted to be be like my dad. I wanted my dad to be proud of me. But, you know, I picked the Marine Corps.
Okay.
The few, the proud, the Marines, right? You see the signs now? It says, we don't accept applications. We only take commitments.
There's a billboard right outside the office.
Right, same thing.
Just looking at this morning.
So, you know, I was going to get in the best. I mean, it wasn't just good enough for me to go in the Army.
Right.
I had to be a Marine now.
Yeah.
I don't swim. It's not a good idea to try to become a Marine when you're not a good swimmer.
So what happened?
Well, I joined at 17. My mom had to sign the papers. I went to boot camp. That's where I got sober for the first time because I went through withdrawals. I was drinking every day.
Wow.
And so boot camp was a nightmare, but you add on top of it withdrawing from alcohol. Yeah. I had a double nightmare on my hands, and I didn't even know it. See, I wasn't even aware of these kinds of things. after boot camp was over, several of my friends had volunteered for Vietnam. I volunteered and I was sent to Vietnam when I was 18. And then in Vietnam, I started to really experiment with drugs other than alcohol. And I came back with a very serious alcohol slash drug problem.
Heroin?
I experimented with heroin while I was over there. I didn't, thank God, get to the point where I was shooting it yet. But that would have happened. That was coming. Mm-hmm. Because I was now starting to experiment with shooting barbiturates. So that's where my bottom was. I abscessed. I shot some barbiturates, I missed, or the guy that shot me missed, my arm swelled up.
Okay, yeah.
All right, stop that. So then I came back from Vietnam, got busted on my way to my final duty station by some LAX police officers, and they didn't arrest me, but they told me they were going to turn me in.
You had heroin on you.
I had marijuana, LSD, speed on me. And so I thought I'm going to the brig, and I didn't want to go to the brig. I'd rather go to a, you know, jail than to the brig. Mm-hmm. So what happened was is that when I got to base, I tried to figure out, well, how can I manipulate the situation and get out of the trouble, right?
Yeah.
So I acted like I wanted help. I went to my first sergeant, said, hey, Top, look at my arm. Mm-hmm. I need help. I came back from Vietnam. I've got this problem. And he looked at me and says, Berger, you are one lucky guy. He says, 3 days ago, the Marine Corps decided that we're going to give you guys amnesty.
Really?
There's a drug exemption program, so you're not going to be prosecuted. We're not going to throw you in the brig, but we're sending you treatment.
Wow.
So I was the third Marine admitted to this program on the third day that this program existed.
That's amazing.
Or came into existence. Yeah, it was amazing. Saved my life.
And that's when you got sober and you haven't
had a drink. That was 1971. Yes.
And what was this treatment like?
They had no idea what they were doing, but they knew that, and so they turned to the 12-step community.
That's
and they
great.
Brought in some young people that had received help from this woman called Flo Bird, who was this AA guru. She's this 50-year-old hippie lady walking around in a bikini all the time, wearing Birkenstocks, long hair down to her butt, you know. And
very
she
70s.
Just very 70s, right? You know, picture 70s, look at her.
Yeah.
She was it. I mean, she was like the... you know, a great example, you know, an icon of that time. And she helped all these young people find the 12-step way of life.
That's amazing.
A lot of them. And she was an amazing woman. She had that kind of earthy knowledge and wisdom that she imparted. And people saw it in her and saw that she really loved them. And that's what really did it. I mean, she loved people. And they knew it. And, you know, when you get loved unconditionally like that, you just grow.
Yeah.
And these people were growing around her. All of this recovery was taking place. And back in the 70s, there weren't a lot of young people in the program. So this group of young people, they were called Flo Bird's Birds.
Where was this?
This was on the island of Oahu.
Wow.
So there was a, like 30, 40 young people that were just, you know, it was like the Pacific group in on the island of Oahu. There was this but not rigid. It was hippie.
Yeah.
It was a hippie Pacific group.
She was Clancy?
She was like a hippie Clancy.
Yeah.
But it would be fun to make hippie into Clancy into a hippie, wouldn't it? I'd have a lot of fun. You don't think he'd...
other topic.
That's all. But so look, so they came, so two Toms came to talk to us on Tuesday nights. They set up an opportunity to come in. They called it the drug rap session.
Mm-hmm.
So they would come and spend 2 hours sharing their stories. And I was blown away. I was blown away at the freedom that Tom had. And Tom McCall, he doesn't mind me sharing his name, he became my sponsor. And I was, like I said, I was so moved by the fact that he wasn't in bondage of himself, right? That he had found a freedom inside, and I wanted that. That's why I drank, really.
Yeah.
And that's why I used. I wanted to be free.
And so when did you make your way to L.A.?
I had another year to do in the Marine Corps, so I finished in 1972. I was given an honorable discharge. They attempted to keep me in. They gave me a promotion just before I left, but I wanted to go to school. So I went back to Chicago, 72, 73, had to clean up, make a lot of amends. I hurt a lot of people back then. And then I got an offer to come out here into California in 1973 to work at... one of the first programs that worked with the children of alcoholics and the families, some Navy personnel at the Western Institute of Human Resources in Long Beach, California.
And you were just a high school graduate at that point?
I was a high school dropout with a GED, and I was in my second year in college when I moved out here. And then I started going to Cal State Long Beach, and Long Beach led to UC Davis, where I got my PhD.
My mom got her PhD there.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah,
huh?
hers was in English, and then yeah. She was an adjunct professor there for a long time.
Oh, it's a great campus. I learned a lot at this school. Helped. In fact, when I applied there, it was an interesting story. I share with everybody about my recovery because I want to be open. If you're uncomfortable with me, then that's not a place I want to be. So I put on my application that I'm a recovering alcoholic addict.
Right.
So the psychiatrist is interviewing me. He says, did you at all think about putting that down, that might be detrimental to your application? And I said to him, look, if you are uncomfortable with me being in recovery, then this isn't the place I want to be.
Yeah, wow.
I need to be open about it. It's a real important part of my life. It saved my life.
Yeah.
And so if you guys can't handle that, with me being open about that, then this isn't this program for me.
And boy, did they take you in at that point.
It was like, wow, this guy is really committed to his journey.
And so you got your PhD, you're living up north, and then you came back.
Came back to Southern California and continued to, at that point, then I decided to open up a clinic that would address stage two recovery issues. So stage two recovery is after you put the plug in the jug, break the bonds of your addiction, you're no longer struggling with your cravings or your desire to drink and use, that obsession's been lifted. Then you move into stage two recovery, which is really trying to now rebuild your life. And for me, all through my recovery, I did a lot of therapy.
Yeah.
So I really saw the value of really rigorously working the steps, but at the same time, getting in front of someone and being vulnerable and starting to look at the issues that I needed to look at and started to address. And so that's what my recovery was based on. Mm-hmm. It had those two foundations as well as, then working with others, going to school, educating myself and stuff like that.
Question, do you believe that people can get sober and work on those issues without sitting down with a therapist?
I think it's possible to some degree, but not to the depth that you're going to get into.
Mm-hmm.
The work I did, let's take my dad, for example. I had a ton of grief. You know that.
Yeah.
You can hear me
talk
about it. You hear my voice change when I talk about him. I missed him a lot, and I didn't want to open that pain up.
Right.
And right after I was probably 3 months into my recovery, I went to a weekend marathon.
Okay.
See, back in the 70s, we were doing a lot of this human potential.
Right.
These weekend encounter groups, right?
So that wasn't AA. That wasn't AA.
No, it was just a weekend marathon with this guy. His name was Sasha from the University of Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And first exercise he did is he said, everybody close your eyes and think of someone you need to say goodbye to. Well, you know who popped up for me.
Yeah.
My dad.
Yeah.
So he heard me share my story briefly, threw a pillow in front of me, said, say goodbye to your father. Well, I don't know many sponsors that would do that.
Yeah.
Right? And I'll tell you, I needed that. He invited me, but the support he gave me through the work and through helping me open up my soul and open up my grief and really draining that was unbelievable. I worked about 3 hours on my pain and grief that night. And at the end of it, I remember the last exercise we did. I was laying on the ground and the room was padded because, we're on bean bags and this is just how you set up these weekend marathons in this kind of a room. And I was doing some pounding. I was pounding my fist, kicking my feet. I was throwing a tantrum. And I think I was raging at God probably at that time. And at the end of that, I said everything I needed to say to God about what I was feeling. And he says, okay, now open up your eyes. Unbelievable. I drop acid and I get this sense of clarity and like I was totally connected to the world and to the universe and to wisdom. And at this moment, I was more connected to life and more alive than I had ever been.
Wow.
It was unbelievable. At that moment, I was hooked on recovery. So alive.
You know, just one thing that one of my experiences, I did that sort of therapy. I went to Meadows for their survivors. Yes. Mm-hmm. One of the worst experiences of my life.
Oh, what happened?
I just hated it. I didn't respond to me. Yeah. I'm like, oh, I'm going to hit a felt bat on a chair and it's going to make me get out my rage at my dad. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
And I was the one person who didn't really respond. It survivors, you're in it with people who are in their third week of
treatment,
which is a terrible idea.
Yeah.
So I was, I don't know, 9 years sober. And so they're feeling for the first time. I've been in therapy since I was 16, blah, blah, blah. And I just, and the leader, and I do call him a leader, not a therapist, because that was the way it was done, told me at the end I needed to check into Meadows to deal with my issues.
Well, see, this is a problem I have. See, I'm writing a new book for Hazleton called 12 More Stupid Things.
Yeah.
And in this book, the first stupid thing that I'm writing about right now, I'm right in the middle of, in fact, what I was waiting for, I was working on my book out.
I did note that you had your computer.
Yes.
I wasn't going to accuse you. When we were doing my therapy, I was going to be like, you can't stop either.
Well, no, I'm really kind of trying to fit it in, but you're right, I can't. Mm-hmm. That's one thing I do. The first one is believing that there's one path.
Yeah.
To getting and staying sober.
Right.
And see, a guy like that, that is putting his idea about what you're supposed to do on you and not staying tuned into you, that's what we got to get cleaned up in this field.
Yeah.
It's not good. It's destructive. It's harmful. It makes people lose trust. It loses credibility in a program. See, so that kind of rigidity I am so against.
Yeah.
Because it's not you. You just, that didn't work for you.
And he was so shaming.
Oh. Yeah, see, so that's the other side of it, is that when a patient doesn't do what we want, we make them feel bad about themselves.
Yeah.
Well, great. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, you see, so these are the things. And what I'm trying to help a client do now is not take that crap from someone.
Yeah.
And so what I'm wanting to do in this first chapter is help someone really get grounded in, nobody can tell you what you need.
Yeah.
That's up to you. But this is the real important part of it. But you got to learn how to pay attention to yourself so you know what you need. Because a lot of us desensitize ourselves. We don't want to feel. We don't want to know.
Yeah. I mean, I was luckily sober enough to get that it was this guy's problem.
Yeah, good for you.
But I was still angry.
Of course. Well, look, he polarized with you.
Yeah.
He broke the alliance. The one thing we know, now if I go put my psychologist hat on, the one thing we know is that people who have a strong therapeutic alliance with their counselor or their therapist do well. If that alliance is shattered, you know, therapy isn't going to work. A treatment center isn't going to work. You know, if you read Ann Fletcher's book, you know, Inside Rehab.
I can't read those. I did read Gabrielle Glazer's, but I really generally can't read
those. Well, I have a problem with many of the issues in there. But one of the things I think was important in terms of the message is we got to clean up how we treat people that don't fit with what we think they should do.
Yes, I agree.
See,
in terms of 12-step.
In terms of 12-step, same thing. Look, I see sponsors doing numbers on sponsees all the time. You've probably seen it. You've been around, you know, like I've been around. Look, I've heard sponsors shame people to the point of that person thinking about going back out and never wanting to come back to the program.
Yeah, well, I had a PG sponsor for half a minute where we were doing step work in her car, and I casually mentioned I'm on SSRIs, and she goes, "You're not sober. Get out of the car."
Yes.
I mean,
there's an example of it.
Yeah.
Way too rigid for me. Way too rigid.
Well, if SSRIs are working, that can kill people.
Okay, exactly. Look. Exactly. So, you know, so see, that's the part I think we gotta, that's what I'm hoping to do with 12 More Stupid Things, is really helping people learn to hold on to themselves better.
Yeah.
And not let somebody else define what you need and what's, now, there's a paradox here. And you know this, and I know this. I had to be open to suggestions to try them on.
Right.
So there has to be some openness. I can't just be defiant and say, no. But I need to try it on to see, does this work for me? Look, I work a different program than my sponsor, Tom. I've had the same sponsor for 44 years now.
Wow.
But we work a different program. Mm-hmm. He's got a great program. I think I have a solid program, right, in terms of what's going on in my life and how I feel. He's got a solid program, but they're different.
Yeah.
You know, we need different things.
Well, and that, I think, is the the issues that the anti-AA brigade has, which I think this one incredibly solid point that they make is that there is this 12-step philosophy, and it's in the literature, that basically says, if you don't do what we do, jails, institutions, and death. And that is not true.
That is not true.
It is probably true for me. I love the 12-step, so
the way I translate this in is to say that, look, if you don't address your problem, whether you do it with the steps or not, and that's one of the messages I hope to carry, there's certain things you got to do to address this. The first thing is you got to realize if you have this problem, you can't drink or use like other people.
Yeah.
And if you keep trying to find ways of doing that, you probably are going to end up in jail, you're going to end up dead or something like that. So there has to be some help in being able to look at your attitude towards this problem.
Right.
So AA does it in their way by saying, hey, admit you're powerless, right? So that addresses this whole issue with the addiction. Doesn't have to be that way, but that needs to be addressed, right?
Yeah.
Got to look at that. If you deny that, no matter what you're doing, it's not going to work. And see, so that's what I'm trying to help people say, is that there are certain things that need to happen in recovery, but they don't need to happen in a 12-step. They can happen. People are going to smart recovery right now. That seems to be, speaking to some people. Rational recovery was one of those groups, like smart recovery, an alternative, right?
Yeah.
Where they had you learned how to deal with what they called the alcoholic voice within you, and to deal with that voice so that you wouldn't. And they had 24 hours a day. They had the big plan: you'll never drink the rest of your life. So they switched things around, but it was they got to deal with the addiction first.
Yeah. Yeah. So your take on harm reduction is that it's
a ridiculous idea.
Hmm.
It's just, look, it's if we what we know about the brain says that can't work. Now, I'm not saying that somebody that cuts back, that's not helpful for them. I'm not polarizing. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that they're never going to establish their recovery if they don't put the plug in the jug, if they don't stop drinking and using. See, so that's the big issue. Now, look, does harm reduction help people? Oh, yeah. And are people's lives better because they've cut it down? My experience is nobody can do that forever, though. You know what I mean? They might back off for a period of time. But what I've seen with people, and I've encouraged some of my patients to try it. Because I don't know.
Right.
It might work for
right.
you. I haven't seen it yet.
Well, but there are also people who end up seeking sobriety who, it turns out, are not alcoholics.
Well, then they may be able to do that. Those people don't come to my office.
Yeah.
I get people who've tried a lot of other things, and they come to me because they're desperate to try to figure something out.
What portion of your clients are addicts?
I'd say about a good 75%,
yeah.
About three-fourths of my practice.
So word got out that you're a guy to go to you're struggling with that.
Yeah, that's right.
And do you only practice in Westlake Village? Do you have another?
No, I'm not practicing in Westlake. Right now, my primary office is in Hermosa Beach, California.
Okay.
So I've been in the South Bay for a long, long time, since the 80s. So I'm very, very well networked. People know of me. I've worked with two or three generations of families there.
Wow.
So I'm very, very, networked in the South Bay. I'm up in West LA one day a week, and I'm going to probably, because I'm commuting from Westlake to Hermosa Beach, I'm going to probably just have 3 days down in Hermosa, try to open an office up in Westlake and start to see some clients up there.
Mm-hmm. What, and how many books have you written?
So I have 4 books and a pamphlet that's out. First book was Love Secrets Revealed, and it was sharing all the stuff I learned from my mentor, Dr. Walter Kempler.
Oh, yes.
So my professional mentor, right?
Yes, I printed out information about him.
Yeah, Walt Kempler is amazing. Genius.
Oh, and so what I read on your website, which is really interesting, is this idea that we pick a partner to, quote, grind against.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what I was wondering about that is, if we're all trying to redo the trauma that happened under, when we were under the age of 12 or 15 or whatever it is, I know plenty of people, self included, who would seek partners in this ridiculous idea that we could redo it right.
Yeah.
And pick partners who were not appropriate or not available. But you're talking about something else.
I'm talking about something that's it's related to what you're talking about. But look, no matter what happens, whether you were traumatized or not, your development is incomplete. Your family could only teach you what they know.
Mm-hmm.
It's never enough.
Mm-hmm.
So whether you got traumatized in that or not, you're still going to leave your family needing to continue to grow and develop.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the psychological imperative that governs me, governs you, is our movement towards becoming whole,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Of being the best we can be, of realizing our potential. Maslow called it the growth force, self-actualization,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's in each of us. So what I say, it's a variation on what you just said, is I say we pick someone who's going to cause us a certain kind of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And in that trouble, so that trouble doesn't mean something's wrong. That trouble means something's right.
Mm-hmm.
Because relationships are the best way to grow a person.
Right.
The the struggle that goes on, right, really becomes the fire and that forges your person and your character. So the trouble I have is always going to be at the edge of my competence and my abilities. So let's say that we're in a relationship and I'm stuck in people pleasing.
Mm-hmm.
And what comes up with us is that I'm not asking for some of the things I want and I'm getting mad at you.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So my growth is learning how to stand up for what I want. Well, if you don't enable me and mm-hmm. try to anticipate all my needs and you're doing your thing, you know, I might sit there at first and say, God, she is such a selfish, you know, person.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
She's not attending to me at all. But then if I'm really doing the work, I got to say, how come I'm not asking her for what I want?
Right.
How do I find my voice? See, so that's what I'm saying, is that in a relationship, you're going to have opportunities to take the next step in your development. That doesn't mean that relationship is something you should hold on to the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
But it means that there is an opportunity, no matter what it is, for you to grow
mm-hmm.
and for you to develop these parts of you that are undeveloped.
Mm-hmm. Do you believe, you know, I know we talked about therapy is crucial. Somebody should be in therapy for the rest of the time they're sober?
No, I haven't. I do believe there's times, you know, to go in therapy for a period of time. A lot of people come and see me for a period, sometimes for just a few sessions. Sometimes people come in for a couple years,
mm-hmm.
and then they take a break, and then they hit another rough spot, and they mm-hmm. come back. See, mm-hmm. what the model we're starting to get to in understanding what needs to happen in treatment is this chronic disease model. So, look, I have asthma.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't taken any Advair today. I haven't done anything to manage my asthma. I'm in a pretty good place today.
Mm-hmm.
About 5 weeks ago, when I was moving and stressed out, my asthma was kicking in. I needed to take my medication.
Mm-hmm.
So we need different things depending on what's going on in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of recovery I want people to put together. Be responsive to what's happening in your life and attend to what you need. So sometimes you're going to need to get your butt in and do some work.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you don't need to.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you need to be going to maybe 7 meetings a week. There may be times when you don't need to go to any meeting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean you're not in recovery, because recovery is not going to meetings or going to meetings. It's an attitude you have and a way that you're living your life.
Mm-hmm.
And see, that's the important thing, is that we somehow internalize that. What I say to everybody, in the beginning, the program worked me.
Mm-hmm.
I worked the program. Then the transition came.
Right.
Now the program works me.
Right.
If I'm dishonest with you, I can't live with myself. I got to come and clean it up.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
yeah.
It just doesn't work. Before, somebody had to tell me, hey, you were dishonest. You better go clean that up.
Yeah.
Doesn't happen anymore. I know I need to clean it up now.
And what about these people that, you know, I knew people when I was new who were amazing, and I could see the freedom that you saw in Tom, and then they stayed, they're still sober, and there's just this hatred, and there's this...
That's where they're not staying in touch with their experience.
Yeah.
Because, see, one of the important ingredients, I think, in recovery is being able to tolerate looking at who you're not yet.
Right.
And being able to be honest with yourself about, you know, I've got 40 years, but I still need to clean this thing up.
Right.
I've got 44 years. I still find myself passive in certain areas, especially in my marriage with
mm-hmm.
my wife.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of where I don't support myself to go after what I want.
Mm-hmm.
So see, those are the things that at 44 years, I'm looking at that and wanting to look at it and wanting to see what I can do, right, to start to fulfill my life rather mm-hmm. than to sit there and hope somebody's going to figure this out. Now, there's not a lot of me that's passive anymore, but there's some areas where I am. That's my issue. Mm-hmm. But see, we got to tolerate seeing those things mm-hmm. and then being able to support ourselves in working on it without me shaming myself and say, oh, look at what a terrible person you are. Well, I'm not going to go get help if I feel ashamed of it.
Right, right. Would you say that one of the best things that can therefore be a very low tolerance for discomfort, emotional discomfort?
It can be.
Because it gets you trying to do stuff.
To look for something new. Right on. This is where we learn pain becomes our friend, not our enemy.
Yeah. I mean, I know a lot of people, I will say men, who seem to be comfortable wallowing in their misery.
Yeah.
And I don't relate to that.
No, listen, I think that there's a lot of what we call toxic rules that men have swallowed whole. We call it introjected. Mm-hmm. So if I introject something, I take an idea and I believe it completely without ever examining, does this idea make sense for me? You follow mm-hmm. me?
Yeah.
That's an introjection. Introjections are really toxic
mm-hmm.
because you're not in it.
Right.
So you got to take that idea and chew it up. And say, these are the parts of that idea that fit for me and are going to help me and thrive in my life. And these are the parts of the idea that don't. What do we tell people going to meetings? Take what you need.
And leave the rest.
And leave the rest. So right. we're asking people to be active in their experience in recovery, but we don't give them the tools because then we say, well, if you're not following directions, you obviously don't want to do what? Get well.
Right, right.
Instead of saying, what is it about this idea that doesn't fit well for you? Let's talk about it and see what might work better for you. But see, that's a level of sophistication. I don't want to put that on sponsors and stuff like that. But see, that's where we got to get to in terms of our consciousness. Because Bill had that. Bill didn't think we were supposed to lay our ideas about, let's say our ideas about God on someone else.
Yeah.
Right? That we had to be open to let that person discover and find whatever higher power they needed to find in their life, and that it didn't need to be the one that we thought they needed.
Well, isn't the AA history that there was that they did think it had to be God, and then that guy came in and said it needs to be God as you understand him.
Because Bill also could appreciate that because of his experience in the Oxford group. See, the mm-hmm. Oxford group was very Christian, and if you didn't embrace Jesus, then you weren't going to get well.
Right,
and it didn't work for Bill.
Right.
So he knew there had to be something that there was more tolerance,
right.
that there was more possibilities. What I would say, there had to be something less rigid.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you look at the original manuscript, which they published now.
I have it. I thought I'd read through it.
But if you just pick up a few pages and look at it, you see what they did is they tried to back off on the rigidity. Thankfully.
Yeah.
Had it been rigid, I would have been too, I couldn't have, it wouldn't have worked for me.
Mm-hmm.
I would have been too defiant.
Mm-hmm. We still have more time. What I was going to say before, this is going back, is this idea that we were talking about like that counselor that I talked about at Meadows. There can be sponsors who are like that.
Yes.
And I think a lot of those people who go on these anti-AA crusades, what they will not mention in their crusade is that they tried AA and it, quote, didn't work.
Yeah.
Because there were personalities.
Yes.
I feel grateful all the time that I stumbled into a room where I never encountered that. But that was luck.
Yes. It's interesting because I had as I mentioned before, I've gone on and I did a review on Ann Fletcher's book on Amazon, and I gave it one star. I'm going to probably go back in and change that at some point. But I'm pretty polarized with it because I felt it was way too heavy-handed in mm-hmm. one direction. Now, the truth of it is when you read it, it's more balanced than I think people realize.
Mm-hmm.
But there was one person who really came after me and was attacking me.
Mm-hmm.
And I invited that person to share with me their experience. I didn't want to do it in the public forum. But send me a personal email and let's talk about what happened. And it was just this. See, they had a bad experience.
Yeah.
And they blamed the other person for what they didn't know how to do.
They blamed AA for what they didn't
exactly
know how to do.
They didn't know how to hold on to themselves. And they were expecting that other person, it was a treatment program. It was a counselor who was lame, who was really, I think, poorly trained.
Oh, it was a counselor that you were writing
about. No. Yeah, that this person had an experience in a treatment center.
Okay, yeah.
So they went to treatment. This counselor totally polarized with them, mm-hmm. faulted them, blamed them, says, you don't want to get well. Totally alienated this mm-hmm. client, mm-hmm. right? Like, similar to what your experience. Mm-hmm. Maybe not as, this was more extreme than I think you had. But I talked to him about it. I said, look, you can blame them, but why don't you look at what you couldn't do at that time?
Right.
Let's look at how you didn't hold on to yourself. Because had you held on to yourself, you wouldn't be reacting to this other person this way. And so we spent some time going back and forth, trying to help him unpack the experience mm-hmm. that he was having. Now, a good therapist would have saw your reaction, and instead of overriding you and telling you to go into treatment, they would say, look, I can see that when I talk to you this way, it doesn't fit for you. Let's find out what's going on. Maybe I've missed you, mm-hmm. and I don't want to miss you. Mm-hmm. You see, so they would own the mistake. Mm-hmm. How many counselors own their mistakes?
Yeah. What's interesting, and this is related, is that once I, got sober and my life was changed as a result of AA, I got into this way of thinking, I still have it a little bit, which is God is speaking to me through other people.
Yes.
So whatever suggestions are coming along, I'm meant to follow.
Yes.
And you could say I'm not holding on to myself, but I had an amazing therapist at the time, and she was the one who suggested Meadows. And so I come back from it, and I go, I had this horrible experience, and she was shocked. And she said, I'm going to reach out to this counselor. And she was so, quote, on my side. And I was so impressed with how she admitted that it had been a mistake.
Yep.
And then she talked to him. This amazing woman, who I still know today, came back and was, like, on his side.
Wow.
And it was so interesting because she had already admitted fault. And I just sort of, I don't know, I was like, two therapists connecting. Like, what happened in that conversation?
That's very interesting, though, isn't it, that... Yeah, somehow she didn't see. I hold that counselor responsible for the breach of the connection to you.
Yeah.
Because that person wasn't meeting you where you were at.
Yeah.
That wasn't for you.
Yeah.
Look, to me, I never hand somebody a bat and say, beat the chair. But if you were in the middle of your anger and see they were a better therapist, they would have then handed it to you at the right time and you would want it.
Yeah.
But doing it the way they did felt artificial for you because you weren't there.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of felt like I've been dealing with my rage towards my dad since I was 18. It's somewhat, it's alleviated so much.
Yeah. Right. And see, what I've always said, and this, I go into this a lot in 12 Smart Things,
mm-hmm.
which is all about emotional sobriety. If I'm upset, then what's underneath it is some unenforceable rule that I have about how you're supposed to behave.
Mm-hmm.
And that rule is connected to my unhealthy dependence on you.
Mm-hmm.
So I have the rule that says you have to behave this way for me to feel okay.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't do it, then I'm mad at you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And see, that's what we call expectations are what premeditated resentments. Right. You've heard that, right? You've heard that in meetings a lot. So see, that's what I would want to unpack with someone mm-hmm. is to help them get to the unenforceable rule that is generating their resentment or their anger or their pain mm-hmm. or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Which I agree with you that that's crucial, and that's why the fourth step is so life-changing.
Critical.
Out of all of them, I think even more than the first step. I say fourth is the one that just...
Powerful, isn't it? To take a look at yourself and to be able to tolerate, right, what you're going to see, who you're not.
Yeah.
You know, I love the way Bill says it. He says, you have to look at who you're not to become what you can be.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, but I paraphrase it a little bit.
But
isn't it? But he says it. We have to own who we've been or what we've done in order to become what we can be.
Yeah.
See, so it's a variation on that, but it's there's a lot of wisdom in it. See, in Gestalt therapy, we have what's called the paradoxical theory of change. So what it means is that you change when you own what's going on, not when you try to be someone you're not. So if I have this disease, which I do, that makes it impossible for me to control my drinking
over any extended period of time, if I keep trying to be in control of something I'm out of control over, I'll never change. Mm-hmm. That's why the first step works, because as soon as you accept your powerlessness, you find power.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Same thing. If I'm a liar, where I start to get honest is by owning that I'm a liar.
Mm-hmm.
I can't just get honest. Mm-hmm. I've got to own that I lie and take a look at it, what it means to me. So the person that's trying to control, they have to unpack, how come I can't accept this idea that I'm powerless?
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a lot of reasons for that, right? Who the hell wants to be powerless?
Right.
Our society doesn't, you know, applaud somebody,
exactly,
right?
Yeah.
Hey, oh, you're powerless. Wonderful. Let's go spend some time together.
Yeah.
You know, our society is about power and it's about achievement. It's about success. And
yeah. I mean, and it is the great irony. And, you know, the point that all those anti-AA crusaders will use is like powerlessness. Like they don't get that powerlessness is power.
They don't see how it empowers somebody.
Well, and people don't get that losing an argument is winning.
I know. See, you're right on. But, you know, not only do they not get it, I go train a lot of mental health professionals. They are so critical of the steps because they think the steps promote irresponsibility.
It's so crazy. I mean,
think about it. Are you more responsible than you've ever been?
Of course.
Right?
And like that cursory glance at 12 step and then the right they have to sort of tear it apart. And I mean, I think one of the issues that is inescapable is that I don't think you can understand 12 step if you're not trying to be sober.
One of the things that I'm very happy about in my most recent book, which was 12 Hidden Rewards of Making Amends. First part of that book is all about the therapeutic value of the steps. So one of the talks I give to mental health professionals is help them see the psychological forces that are operating in the steps. It is grounded in good therapy.
Yeah.
I am telling you.
Yeah.
And so when they see it, they can start to look at it from a different point of view instead of thinking, oh, that's a religious program because God's mentioned, right?
Right.
That just throws a psychologist off big time.
Yeah. But threatens what they do.
It totally threatens what they do, yeah. There's such a split between spirituality and psychology, which is so sad. Now, some groups have tried to put it together, transpersonal psychology, different things like that. But it's still in the mainstream. There's a terrible misunderstanding of what happens with the steps in the mental health profession.
Yeah,
And amongst other people, too.
But it's changing.
It is.
You know?
Thankfully.
And, you know, Dr. Drew has talked about how in medical school, it's actually finally getting addressed in more than like a lecture or whatever it's been.
That's so good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Really is.
Yeah.
I agree with that. I'm so glad for that.
Okay, I wanted to answer a question with you. I get sent these questions periodically, and then I will answer them. And look, we got an expert in the house. So this is a guy who has, Jonathan, who's been like a long time sort of, you know, online friend. And he wrote, I had a drug dream. Happens about twice a year. Does anyone else go through this? Sometimes in the dreams I'm straight up using. Sometimes the dream is just about drugs. Sometimes I'm holding them. Okay, you get the idea. Now he says, is that okay? I mean, it's not a relapse if I'm dreaming, even if it felt real and I enjoyed it. What do you have to say?
Well, so what he's questioning is he heading for trouble because he liked the experience he had in that dream.
Right.
And what I would say if Jonathan was in a session with me, I'd say, let's work on your dream for a minute. So here's a secret in terms of unraveling what happens in a dream. Every part of the dream is a different part of you.
Mm-hmm.
So what I have the person do is tell the dream from different points of view. So I have him tell it from his point of view. Then I have him become the drug and tell it from the drug's point of view. I have him tell the dream from every different object that's in the dream from that point of view. What I'm looking for is any areas where there's conflict between him and different parts of the dream. So what I then do is now I have him dialogue like we were doing that dialogue earlier, the different parts of the dream. So let's say it's him and the drug.
Mm-hmm.
And he might be saying, you know, God, I don't know what to make of you. You know, you've come in, you make me feel good. I pushed you away for a long time, and now you're coming into me. Now, what it may be is that there's a part of Jonathan that he's starting to connect to that hasn't been okay to connect to. that's making him feel better, and he doesn't know how to integrate that into his personality. Do you see what's happening?
Yeah, yeah.
See, I don't want to interpret it.
Right.
Because I want people to figure it out themselves. But if you ask me what I think is going on, there's a part of him that's starting to come into his life that he likes, that he feels good about, but he doesn't know what to do with it yet. And he doesn't know where to put it, doesn't know how to integrate it into the rest of his personality. So see, if that was it, then we'd work on that. You see what I mean?
That's an amazingly optimistic interpretation, too. I mean, I love it. You have had drug and alcohol dreams,
yes.
I would imagine.
Yeah.
I always take them as like, oh, good, you know, the detritus of my thoughts are being processed through my dreams. And and I think, you know, if you're in a lot of meetings,
yeah.
that can happen. You're
right.
thinking about drugs and alcohol. I never take it as a dangerous thing.
Yeah.
Ever. But that's me.
Yeah. And I don't, you know, that's what I said. For
yeah.
him, I'm just, I don't know Jonathan, but that's the hit I get off of it.
Yeah.
And what I'm always looking for is something like that. So you've also seen another part of my work. I'm always looking for the positive intention in
yeah.
our behavior.
Yeah.
Because it's always there.
Yeah.
And see, we are much too harsh and critical of ourselves.
Oh, yeah.
That we are... There's forces in us that are moving towards our growth and development that we don't recognize all the time.
Right.
And I want people to be aware of that so that they can start to appreciate themselves. Because we're amazing. You're amazing. I love talking to you, by the way.
Thank you. I love talking to you. I was just, I escaped the moment and I was like, God, this is a good one. I was just thinking about
yeah.
that. I was only half listening to you because I was
yeah,
thinking that.
No, but it's, happens. I love your energy. See, you're so here. I mean, people can't see how we look at each other. And
well, it's kind
content.
Of made me uncomfortable because you are totally an eye to eye person.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
yeah.
shit, he's going to know if I look away that
yeah,
like
that.
I'm uncomfortable. And then he's going to talk about that.
But see, look at how real you are about that
yeah.
and transparent and vulnerable you
yeah.
are. See, that's what I love talking to you because you're so here with me.
That's
See, awesome. We're totally here. I
yeah.
mean, we're in this, you have this wonderful office in this other wonderful office.
Yes.
But there's all this other stuff going on. Most of the time, I'm not aware of anything.
Yeah.
Except you.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
your eyes and talking to you and your mouth and your words and the tone of your voice and...
It's interesting. We have to wrap up, but I can't stop talking to you. I have this, one of my sort of, you know, self-hating things that goes through my head is you're not present, you're not listening. And I went through this period like 2 months ago where I started to be so conscious in my conversations of how I wasn't listening. And I finally took it as progress because there was awareness and it
yes.
used to just be waiting for the person to finish talking so that I could talk. I had
right.
no awareness that I wasn't listening.
Yeah. See, that's what I'm talking about with you is your awareness of what you're doing and owning it.
Yeah.
See, that's the part that I want people to get in here. That's how we grow.
Yeah.
Is not to be where we think we should be, but to be where you're at and become aware of it.
Right.
By doing that, then you start to move to the next thing of being more present.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you can't jump over that step.
Yeah, and it makes people super uncomfortable, and
yeah.
they don't like
yeah.
it, and they quit, and, you
yeah.
know, all that stuff.
That's right.
Okay, we have to wrap up. People can reach you on your website.
Yep.
Dr. Allen Berger, A-L-L-E-N.
B-E-R-G-E-R. Website is www.abphd.com.
What? That's your website?
Yeah, abphd.com. And then you can also send me an email at abphd@msn.com.
And do you have time to answer those?
Oh, yeah. I try to answer every... Sometimes it takes a few days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if anybody needs to reach me for any reason, my phone number is 818-584-4795.
Wow.
So you can also give me a call, and I'll do my best to get back to you as soon as I can.
And you got room in your practice for new clients?
I'm probably got about a 1 to 2 week waiting list right now.
Mm-hmm.
So depending on your flexibility, if somebody's flexible, I can typically work them in.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, I'm in that process of writing right now. So
yeah.
I'm starting to, the deadline's coming up in October to have the book ready. And so I'm now starting to put some hours aside every day
mm-hmm.
to sit down and focus on that. But still, I see about 40 patients a week, or if not more.
And all your books are available on Amazon.
Yes. That's the best place to get them. That's where you're going to get the best price.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, I also got some great CDs. Let me just say that website. A lot of great CDs. You can go on iTunes. You can download my CD on Unpacking Bill Wilson's Letter, which is on emotional sobriety. That is a great, that is, to me, one of my best talks. But on my website, I've got several other audio CDs that if you want something to throw in your car, listen to when you're driving to a meeting or driving home from work or whatever. They're great things. In fact, I'll get you a collection of them.
Oh, so I love it. So, yeah, I'll go download the Unpacking the
Letter. You'll like Bill's letter a lot.
Is that like a full hour of you unpacking it?
It's a full hour of going through that letter that was published in the 1958 Grapevine, which that letter, outside of the big book in a 12 and 12, go and read the letter. You can get the PDF on the internet, type in Bill Wilson, The Next Frontier, Emotional Sobriety, and you'll see the PDF of it. Read it. It's so powerful. It's so good. And I unpack it in that program that's on iTunes.
Yeah, okay, that's a must listen. And you guys, you're already listening to something you got on iTunes or SoundCloud or whatever, so
that's it.
You know how to download.
They do know how to download.
Okay, Dr. Berger, thank you so much.
You,
this
man.
Has been fantastic. That was a great episode, right? I mean, I loved it, but I also liked it because he gets into complimenting me in the end. Did you hear that? Yeah, I'm working on my narcissism, guys. You know that. Anyway, this was After Party Pod with Dr. Alan Berger. Thank you for listening. See you next time.